The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. The first month of your membership is 99 cents, so sign up today by going to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. Thanks, Gaia. The Paranormal Podcast is also brought to you by Harry's. And we're going to be telling you about a very special offer today. So stay tuned and keep listening. Thanks, Harry's.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you again. And boy, am I excited. We're having a good 2017 so far and getting some great guests lined up. I think that you're going to enjoy what we have coming forth. And today is no exception. We have two great guests. Jody Levon, the happy medium, joins me, and we're going to talk about intuition. And then in part two, Jan Bondesen returns to talk about strange Victoriana. So two great guests, a power-packed, super-length show. So I hope that you enjoy it very much. And here is the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest today is the happy medium, Jody Levon, and she has a brand new book out, and it looks great. It's called The Happy Medium, Speaking the Language of Intuition. Now, Jody has been at this for quite some time and has a great following. She is an accomplished medium with over 30 years of experience. She is the founder of the Intuitive Coach LLC, and she offers corporate coaching, private readings, and inspirational presentations on a national level. Jody is a prominent local and national radio personality and is the resident psychic on a successful television show in the Midwest, Twin Cities Live. The Happy Medium, Speaking the Language of Intuition, is her second book in the Happy Medium series. Jody, welcome to the program today.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
Well, we're excited to have you. You know, when I talk to mediums, I'm always interested in the origin story. How did all this start for you?
Well, I mean, honestly, there wasn't one point where I said, oh, I'm a medium. I always have been incredibly sensitive to energy, most particularly people's moods, because I thought if someone was in a bad mood, it was my fault and that I had to fix it. And so it was me wandering into other people's space. But then we would go to my aunt and uncle's house, and there were so many spirits in there, and I would be talking about them, and my parents would be looking at me like, what are you talking about? Or they would be listening to the news. I remember being literally 2 years old and running out of the room because there was a murder, and they were talking about it on the news, and I ran because I could see the person who did it, and I thought the person could see me. So as I got older and I started to understand that not everybody had this, I didn't even know if it was an ability. I just started to learn to not talk about it because nobody was really talking about anybody dead in my house. It was just not a big thing. And I learned that if I knew the teacher was going to be a really great teacher, but she was going to be moody because she was getting pregnant, to not share it with everybody because they didn't know. So it was more like I kind of went underground, but I still used it. I still had a great instinct about who was going to be a good friend. I loved animals. I could talk with animals. But the dead people thing scared me for a really long time. And as I've gotten older, really only in the past, like, maybe 30 years, have I become even more comfortable with that exchange as I understand that everything is energy. So, and I love to talk about it because it makes people less afraid to live if they're not really afraid to die. And I think that's empowering. I like to help people have joy in their lives. That's what I like. That's what I feel like, because I was not the happiest young person. I promised myself I would be a happy adult and I would help other people become happy as well. That's what I'm doing.
That sounds like a fine goal. Now, you mentioned fear of death. I think most people, if they were honest, say they fear death. I raise my hand right here and say I'm afraid of it. And I think in some ways it's more the fear of the unknown. And then, as in my case, many people have been told, you know, if you don't do this, this, and this, you're going to hell. Because I definitely believe in an afterlife. Why do you think people are so afraid to die?
I think It is exactly what you just said. It's the unknown. It's that floating into nothingness. And it's because they haven't, most people have not had a discussion with anybody who's dead. So they don't know that they really do keep moving on. They think they're just done, or as you said, they're going to that hot, dark place. But it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist like that. So people are afraid of that. Also, I think they're afraid of the dying process, because if you see people die or an animal die, that looks pretty scary. So the whole thing, I think, is very scary. But once you start to go, I can open up to my loved one on the other side. I know they're doing things. I'm finding dimes. The phone's ringing. My text is coming through with their phone number, and they've been gone for a long time, and that phone doesn't exist. Something's going on. And it's a good thing, because I can feel my mom on the other side. I can feel her love. And that is when my clients I see kind of start to roll over into not being quite as afraid, or afraid at all. I mean, I'm afraid of the dying process. For me, is a little scary, but being dead, being on the other side, living my life in that way doesn't make me feel afraid.
Another thing that I always like to ask mediums is, what do you feel, see, hear? I know some people are clairaudient, some are clairsentient, it comes through in different ways. What do you experience when, let's say, you're doing your reading? What does Jody LaVon have happen to her?
It's like 3D. I can feel the person's presence. I can feel their emotions. I can smell what their skin smelled like. I can taste their favorite food. Anything they want to explain to me comes into my body, and I am it. And I see things like on a screen in my head. So it's all of it. But because I feel things so strongly, most of it is based on how I feel. So if I'm working with somebody and their grandfather comes through and he was, you know, a bodybuilder, somebody that was just huge, very into health and building muscle, I might actually feel like I have bigger muscles. And so I can say, I feel like I have bigger muscles. I feel like I have a limp on my left side. I have a chip on my tooth. I always had a hankering for pork. I would say what they did, what they liked, how they lived. So my client knows I'm dealing with somebody they know. There's no way to know some of these things. You can't find on the internet that somebody craved pork.
Right. That's a good point. And then I'm assuming you hear back from these people and you get the validation that you're tuned in on the right frequency, so to speak.
Absolutely. I absolutely do ask, does this make sense to you? Does this feel like it feels a grandfather energy to me? Could be a father. Do you feel it? Does this make sense to you? And if it doesn't, it's not that that person isn't there. It's that my interpretation is not clicking with them. And that's what most people don't understand, is we're interpreting the information. It comes through it comes through our personality. It comes through the filter of our own experiences. And so when you deal with a medium that you can relate to, you're going to get a medium, you're going to get the words from that medium that you understand, because you click, you get that person. So my readings might come out orange, for instance, if it was a color. Somebody else's might come out green. You need to work with somebody that you can relate to. So oftentimes we're not wrong, we're just interpreting it in a way that doesn't make sense, or our interpretation can be off.
Now, let me ask you this, because I, you know, certainly when you talk about medium psychics, there's a certain percentage, I believe there's a certain percentage that are absolutely the real deal and there is something going on. And then you've got, unfortunately, some people that are less than honest and perhaps they're taking advantage of somebody's loss or those kind of things. And unfortunately, there are people like that in almost every walk of life. And I think that psychics and mediums have gotten kind of tarred by that brush. But let's leave those people aside. Now, a skeptic might say something like this, or kind of a pseudo-skeptic. They might say, well, Jody, there is something going on. They may even go as far as saying, yes, you are receiving something, but you're actually, unbeknownst to you, reading the mind of the person that you're reading. In other words, it's not coming from the other side, but it's coming from the thoughts of that other person. How do you answer that critique that I've heard before?
Love that question. When you're getting a vibration of thought from someone, it comes through differently. Literally, for me, I can see a cloud of smoke coming out of somebody's head. I can feel that I'm connecting directly with them. I'm experienced enough that I can understand that. When I'm communicating with somebody from the other side, my whole face changes. Everything about me, I think my skin becomes warmer. And I can literally see the person in my mind's eye that I'm speaking with. It's very different. So if that person is wondering that, then I would give them a piece of paper with maybe an affirmation that I have in my office, and I'd say, read this. And I would continue talking to the person on the other side and bringing them information. Now, most people that work with me wouldn't say that because they wouldn't be sitting with me, but I agree with you. People wonder things like that all the time. They think we're making it up.
Well, I think you have to ask the question because there is a certain level of skepticism when it comes to your line of work. And I think it's a fair thing to ask. Now, the new book, you talk about speaking the language of intuition. What did you mean by that, the language of intuition?
So everybody has their own language of intuition. Our intuition comes from within, and it speaks through our feelings. When we know how we feel, then we can understand our intuitive signals. But if you're ignoring how you feel, your intuition isn't going to be very clear. So people get hung up in their emotions because their emotions are the story they tell themselves about what their feelings mean. If you can understand that you're telling yourself a story and you can let yourself work that out, you're not carrying around old baggage from a bunch of feelings, and your intuition starts to spark. So when you get yourself into a happy place, and we can talk about that, and then you're more alive to your intuition, so you get a signal where your stomach starts to get butterflies, and you're trying to make a decision, and it feels like there's like butterflies in your stomach, and they're dancing. That's a yes. For most people, that's the language of their intuition. Their solar plexus kind of being light and dancing, and their intuition might feel like their solar plexus are dropping or something in their stomach is just tanking when it's a no. And when you're aware of how you feel, you understand that. Or let's say you meet somebody that later turns out to be one of your best friends, and you remember the moment you met him, the moment, and how you felt. 30 years later, you meet someone else, and that moment flashes in your mind of meeting this best friend 30 years ago. And you know that this person you just met will likely also be someone that you're very close to or very much like your best friend. Does that make sense?
Sure, it makes sense. Now, don't we kind of make it a habit, though, to ignore our intuition and just say, ah, that's a random thought that's occurring to me. That's not really the thing. Recently, I had an instance where I had an intuition about something, and I proceeded with it. And the jury is still out, but I'm wondering if I should have listened to myself. Nothing horrendous or terrible that's going to change my life in any horrible way, and it's something totally undoable. But we're not talking like a marriage or anything like that. Happily married for quite a while now. 20 years. Wow.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. But anyway, the point being that I'm now questioning myself, should I have listened to my intuition? Do we tend to ignore our intuition?
We do tend to ignore it because sometimes it doesn't seem reasonable. But if you put it through this, if you follow your heart, you trust your gut, and you use your head, if all of those three things are in line, it's usually a very solid decision. Now, I would say to you, you did not make a mistake by following your intuition. Rarely is it a mistake to follow your intuition. If after you made the decision, immediately afterwards, did you feel peaceful? Because the language of your intuition would be peaceful.
It's still ambivalent, kind of like it could go either way. Usually I get a gut about something like, yes, this is the right thing to do. Pretty decisively. I'm a pretty decisive person. I make decisions quickly, but I don't think rashly. And I haven't made, particularly what I do now, I've made very few poor decisions.
You needed that decision. Whatever you did, there's something that's going to come from it that's going to bring you information that will help you go further in your life. The fact that you weren't sure is fine. You didn't make a mistake. Whatever happens isn't really a mistake. Because if you felt like you needed to move forward with it, that wasn't a mistake. It might not be the outcome that you're expecting or that you're hoping for, but you need whatever comes to you with that. Now, if you reverse and you think to yourself, should I make this decision or not? One of the best things to do is to say, I'm going to make this decision right now. Am I making it out of my gut or my guilt? And I have an exercise in my book about this. Do I feel peaceful when I feel like I'm going to do it? Or do I feel more peaceful when I think I'm not? And when you're in tune to your feelings, i.e. your intuition, you can tell the difference. If you're peaceful at making the decision, even though it might be a hard one, and you feel like you're going to be peaceful afterwards, that's usually a signal that it's a good way to move forward. You're being ambivalent. My sense is you would have been ambivalent either choice.
That's true. That's a good point. And that's why we're having her on the show, because she has a lot of great insight. Our guest is Jody Levon, the Happy Medium, speaking the language of intuition. We'll have more right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. Well, Happy New Year, everybody. And I know that this past holiday season, I'm sure that many of you got new devices, maybe a smartphone, a tablet, or a streaming TV device. Now the question is, what are you going to watch on it? And may I make a recommendation? I'd like to recommend Gaia. Gaia is the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the topics we love. And Gaia is always providing viewers with tremendous new content, and 2017 is no exception. They're starting the new year off right with a new series called Missing Links, hosted by New York Times bestselling author Greg Braden. Now, the premise of the program is this. In order to thrive in the world emerging before our lives, we need to embrace a new way of thinking. New discoveries reveal our relationship to our ancient past and may hold the keys to the way we think about ourselves, one another, and our world. And once we bridge together the links of our mysterious past and examine new scientific findings, we may finally begin to answer the most important question of all. Who are we? Explore the deep truths of our origin, history, destiny, and fate with Missing Links. Now, I think that you will enjoy this new program, and I know you will enjoy Gaia. You've got all of your other favorites on Gaia: David Wilcock, Regina Meredith, George Norrie, and so much more. And it is a great time to join in this new year, because the first month of your membership, well, it's only 99 cents and you can cancel at any time. Maybe 2017 is the year that you want to kind of expand your intellectual horizons and you want to learn more about all of these kind of areas. Well, one great source for you is going to be Gaia. So, to mine the wisdom and be entertained and enlightened, just go to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. To sign up for your first month, it's only 99 cents. 5,000 years of wisdom now streaming on Gaia. History like you've never seen it. That's Gaia. Thanks, Gaia. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Jody Levon. She is the Happy Medium. Her new book is The Happy Medium, Speaking the Language of Intuition. Now, Jody, in terms of psychic abilities, the ability to be a medium, and I've used this analogy before, so folks have heard this, I apologize. But you take somebody like LeBron James, a great basketball player, obviously was born with a massive amount of talent, but also put a massive amount of work into it to become the world's greatest basketball player. At least I think so. I'm from Cleveland. But anyway, is mediumship like that? I mean, are people born with special gifts? I mean, obviously it sounds like you were, and that some people are just naturals, and that, yeah, I could take a basketball and maybe learn to shoot it into a hoop if there was nobody around me, but I'll never be a great basketball player. Even when I was young, that just wasn't in the cards for me. Is it kind of like that with mediumship, that just some people are going to be superstars, but somebody can do it to some small extent? How does that work?
So it's also like singing. Everybody can sing. If they can speak, they can sing. And some people are born with really strong pipes, and then they train and they really belt it out. And some people squeak, and with training they can sing better, but they're not going to be able to belt it out. It is the passion that we're born with. We choose what we're going to be good at. And when you're in line with what feels right to you, with your intuition, you do what LeBron did. He trained probably from a very, very young age. He started doing this. And that's why he listened to that spark in him, and he knew that's where he wanted to go. It made him happy. And so he did more of it, more of it, more of it. When you do what makes you happy, you are really good at it, and you become even more insightful because you learn to trust that intuition that says, I'm going to do it this way, now I'm going to do it that way. He's happy doing it. He's trusting his intuition. I would bet he uses intuition quite a bit. He gets into that happy place that kind of, I call it a high-flying vibe, where you know you're in the groove, serendipitous events keep occurring, you're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing, and things really go your way. I know a lot of athletes that use that. It's not just a mindset, it's an energy set. He gets himself into that energy. People that want to be more mediumistic, because we're all somewhat mediumistic and we're absolutely all psychic, they can do that by getting to know themselves. And I know I may sound like a broken record, but when you know what your feelings mean, when you understand how you feel, it is a huge, it's an enormous gift, because then you know what excites you and what you're supposed to move forward in. That's what we're successful in. He obviously knew that. A lot of people knew that. You knew that with your podcast. We know those things, and that's why we're good at them. So training to be a medium is the same thing. You start to feel that, and things just start to occur that you read a lot, you test it. You don't ever put anybody on the line with it. You check your motives if you want to be a medium. It's the same thing. It is a skill. It isn't just a gift. It is a skill, and it's a double-edged sword. And I would tell anybody thinking to do it to be very mindful of why they want to do it. What is their motive?
Something I would throw out there, you know, you said that I'm doing it with my podcast. I do believe that's the case. I think this is kind of like meant to be my life's work, although I hope I have a good bit of life left to practice it. But the thing is that it took me a long time. I mean, where LeBron, you know, he was probably playing basketball when he was 10. You know, I was in my 30s, my mid 30s before I even started podcasting, and in 2005, and then in my mid 40s when I started full time. So sometimes it takes a while, and I think sometimes people give up on themselves and give up on life maybe prematurely, and maybe things happen in the universe's time, not necessarily our timeline.
Well, but everything you did makes you good at what you're doing today. I used to cut hair. I had a real estate license. I thought I was going to be a teacher. It took me years to get my college degree. All these different things that didn't just flow perfectly. I found my groove, and then it got better. And finally, well, for me, it was either I would have my intuition or my intuition would have me. It was very clear I was supposed to do this work. But it's all the way it is for me as well as for you because of what we did before. LeBron probably had other things. Maybe school was easy for him, but some social things weren't, although I think he actually does really well socially. I'm using this as an example. Things were supposed to have contrast because it shows us what we want. When we see what we don't want, that's when we know what we want. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And what you said was really very intuitive, ironically, about me, because everything, I worked in traditional media for the better part of 20 years, but my original plan had been go right to the mic and work on the front of the camera or in front of the mic immediately. Didn't work out like that. I ended up working on the business side of media for almost 20 years. And the weird thing is, I didn't get to do the creative stuff. Now, I picked up a lot of that by osmosis and being around personalities and writing copy and all those things, but I didn't actually get to do that thing that I had gone to school for and done it in school and excelled and so forth, ended up on the business side. But now I'm in this situation where a lot of the people who I knew who were just in front of the mic, if they wanted to do what I do as a business, they wouldn't be able to do it because they didn't know the business side of it. And now it's like I feel like I'm kind of like prepared 360 degrees. I hope I'm always improving on the creative side because I think that's where maybe I'm a little bit behind the curve and I need to kind of amp up my skills and always try to get better. But the point is that all this stuff that I kind of loathed at the time has prepared me for what I'm doing today, and I couldn't be happier with what I'm doing today. So things have a way of working out if we kind of flow with it.
Well, and that's, it's like you could put that on a poster. Even when you're in the middle of something, you think it's not working out, it's not going your way. Actually, later on, there's payback. It's amazing how that works, but you have to have trust that where you are is where you are supposed to be, because then you take the pressure off yourself and you enjoy it more, which just then spontaneously pops you into where you're supposed to be even more.
Now, enough about me. Let's talk about you. I mean, when we talk about these gifts and these things, have you seen cases, have you worked with people, not only where you were able to read them and maybe give them some answers from your own ability, but you've actually been able to coach them into utilizing these abilities, even if they're not the superstar level of Jody, can use these abilities to better their lives?
Yes. In fact, my business is called The Intuitive Coach. I do coach people. I help them learn how to recognize how the language of their intuition is speaking to them. Even during readings, I do that. And when I do a reading and I tell them something that I'm sensing, they're shaking their head, yes, like that makes a lot of sense. And oftentimes they'll say, I knew that before, but they didn't trust it. So now they learn how to trust that insight. They learn how to go, oh, okay, that makes sense to them. I teach people not to read other people. I teach them to read themselves. That's what's empowering, because I can give them all the information that, you know, acknowledges something that happened to them when they were 7 years old that actually has colored their whole personality and has caused some of the pain that they're going through now, so then they can resolve that. But then they can start to understand, oh, I'm stuck on something. I get this gut feeling that I'm supposed to move forward and look a little bit closer at that, even though it makes me feel afraid, then I'm not going to keep tripping over it. That's intuition in action. So yes, I teach people that all the time. I want them to leave my office or leave one of my speaking engagements, which I just love to do, feeling more empowered about their own intuition. When you see someone use their intuition, you become empowered to use your own. It's just like when you feel the vibe when someone's singing and you're moved by it, it moves something in you, you get to keep that. So there's a takeaway from every reading.
Now, back to the reading of folks on the other side. Let's say someone's had a loved one who's passed they were very close to, and they believe that they're in a better place, and they believe that there is an afterlife. But yet they don't hear from this person or don't perceive that they hear from this person, and then they start to think, well, maybe there isn't another side, or maybe this person didn't really feel that strongly about me that they had to get in touch. What would you say to a person like that?
I would say that's perfectly understandable. You're not the only person who has felt that way. They are trying to reach you on some level, because virtually they always do. You have to get out of your own way. So if you're thinking that you're going to walk into your bathroom and it's steamed up and you're going to see something on the mirror that says boo, and that's going to be your father, that's not how it works. If you're insisting that you see dimes, that's not how it works. They're going to come through in a way that's meaningful for them, that they know is meaningful for you, that catches you by surprise. So maybe you're going to think, I know I turned that light off in my family room, but it's 2 a.m, I'm going to go turn it off again. You're walking back to your room and you hear click, the light goes back on. And it happens to be the light that your father gave you, the lamp that your father gave you. And this happens night after night for 3 nights. You look at the calendar, it's the anniversary of the time that he died. They come through in ways that you don't expect, but you need to be open to it. And of course, don't be naive. If somebody winks at you, you know, in a parking ramp, that doesn't necessarily mean that's your dad. But if you consistently see cardinals outside your door or outside your window, if every time you talk to your mom, she says something like, I keep seeing cardinals. If there's those coincidences that go on, because of course, there's no such thing as a coincidence, those are signs. If you're dreaming and the dream is in full living color, in fact, the color is even brighter than full real, as we would say, life, you remember every aspect of the dream and you're talking to your dad and he looks really healthy, that's a visit. You can chalk it up to, I missed him, but that's a visit. You have to be open to understanding those quiet dreams that you remember that bring you peace are often visits. Those pennies that you keep finding could very likely be your parent. Be open-minded, and you can ask them. You can say, could you come through in a dream? Could you give me a sign? That little red book that you used to read with me, could you give me the book? Now, obviously, the book might not drop in your lap, but what if you're at a friend's house and their little three-year-old comes and sits on your lap with a little red book? That is how it works.
And the thing that's tough, and I've had this before, because for me it tends to be songs on the radio, but they tend to be obscure songs that would only have a joint meaning. It's not like something that would be very popular.
And license plates with their initials. Do you ever see that?
No, I've never noticed that. But this was one a few months ago, it must have been, and it was near the anniversary, or maybe actually the anniversary of one of my uncles dying, and I walked into a McDonald's, and they play like a 50s station or something from Sirius, or a 60s station. They were playing this relatively obscure song, but it had a specific meaning to me and my uncle, and it was like, And then, of course, I go into the doubting myself. Well, you know, it could just be a coincidence. This is like a 50s, 60s station, so they would play older stuff. But it was just a bizarre song to hear. And it was kind of like, well, maybe I should just stop the skepticism for a moment. And I do these shows all the time, and I'm skeptical. And I should just accept it.
Because does it make you feel empowered? Because that was absolutely a sign. You walked, that music was going to be playing no matter what, but you followed some instinct and probably your tummy, and you walked in and you heard that song and you recognized it. You see, it's all right here all of the time. But you are in a place that you start to recognize it. That's how it works. It was there anyway. Now you're seeing it. Because it's empowering, it's important to acknowledge it. And, you know, do you ever drive around looking for a parking space in a really busy area and you just have a hunch maybe you should just go to the right? Even though you were just to the right, lo and behold, somebody's pulling out of a parking space that's going to fit your car perfectly. I mean, the more you're in tune with that, the more you know that you can be led by those feelings because your stomach feels like it's pulling you in that direction, that's your intuition. That's the language speaking to you. You get all these great goodies. Plus, you're happier.
Another interesting thing to me that's fascinated me, and I wonder if you've made observations about this, is how your life can change from something that's relatively a simple thing. For example, this was the early 90s when I was around 1990 when I was still in college, so that kind of dates me. And back then you had to look through these paper, like newspaper course listing things. We didn't have all the fancy computers to select our courses online and things. And I needed a science credit. And I got interested. I said, because I've always been interested in all of this stuff, even before podcasting existed. And I decided to do a science and religion class. And I specifically remember where I was sitting when I did it. And for some reason, it stood out to me. And I met a young lady and we hit it off and we lost touch. And then we got back in touch 3 years later. And she's in the other room over there. She's my wife. Now, the thing is, if I would have just picked a different course, the course of my life would have totally changed. What about those little decisions? Are those just happenstance, or is that something that the universe is trying to push us towards?
That is something the universe is pushing you towards, and that's something your higher knowing self knew was the right decision for you. Wasn't it that kind of, kind of interesting to me, I think I'll do it, sort of that peaceful, you know, this is kind of different, I think I'll just do that. And you maybe wonder why later you did that, but it turned out to be really great. That was a hunch from inside, and it was meant to be. And if you would have missed that particular door, there would have been another door. So when you feel like I should have done something, don't worry, you'll have an opportunity to do it again. And there would be that same beautiful woman that is in your home right now. But you recognize that moment as, yeah, I'm going to be doing that. People always say, it was seemed really weird, I just kind of made this decision. Well, that's also your intuition. Your intuition doesn't have to be bells and whistles. It's that knowing feeling that comes over you. And for you, it might not shake you. It just might be I'll do that. And I think that's where people think, oh, wait, that's not intuition. But it is intuition. Your intuition is inside of you. It's the relationship you have with your higher knowing soul. It's that knowing part of you. So it's going to speak to you in a way that makes sense. It's not like somebody's going to be singing in your ear, make this decision, there's the love of your life.
Now, where do you come down on ghosts? Because, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. I think in some ways it's reassuring if there are ghosts, because that kind of says, speaks to me that there is something on the other side, assuming they are the spirits of past people and not just kind of some kind of psychic replay. But there's also kind of a disturbing side of it, thinking that maybe somebody is trapped. What do you think about ghosts?
So most people, when they die, so when their spirit disconnects from their body, they go into the light. Most souls go into the light, and that's the other side. There are some who are afraid. Maybe they've done things. Maybe they've killed people. Maybe they stole. Maybe they think because they smoked, they're going to go to a dark place. Or maybe they were so shocked, they didn't even know they were dead because it doesn't feel like what they would think is death. They stay here. They stay kind of, that's the stuck feeling, where they don't go into the light. But they have the opportunity to go into the light. All they need to do is think about it. And there are beings around them, spirits around them, angels around them that will help them into the light anytime. But those disembodied spirits, those I call them earthbound spirits. Those are the ones that can cause some problems in those haunted houses or do things that can scare people. That does feel like they're stuck, but they really aren't stuck. When you walk into a room and you get the creeps and there's no one in the room, and you've heard that there's some weird things that go on, like in Annie Wilder's house, there can be, in Annie Wilder's, she does these haunted tea parties that are so amazing, and there's spirits in there. And some of them, I think, feel a little creepy, and some of them feel really great. But the creepy ones, to me, are the ones that are what you would call stuck. Again, they're not really stuck. But that's the darker side of it. Anybody listening to your podcast, people interested in this kind of thing, know that there's that light. Know that there's that other side. They're not going to be as afraid. So they won't stay here. And when children stay because they don't want to leave their parents or they're afraid that they did something wrong, and I've met spirits that are like that, even at the Mall of America, Dave Schrader and I did a ghost investigation. And I always forget if it's SeaWorld or Sea Life, and I feel really bad about that, but it's beautiful. There was a little girl that was stuck. Well, she was released the minute she heard that she could go, that there was light. So you don't have to feel bad for people, but you do have to know sometimes that heavier, darker energy is exactly that, people who have made the choice to stay in the darkness.
Well, you're a great guest. It's been a great show. Absolutely enjoy it. And certainly anybody interested in this topic should pick up the Happy Medium Speaking, The Language of Intuition. So Jody, where can people find the book and find more about everything you do?
Well, they can go to my website at theintuitivecoach.com, or they can follow me on Twitter at Jody Levon. Also, the book is on, there's an, just press in indie authors. You can go to Amazon. You can go to Barnes & Noble. You can go to local bookstores. I'm really working on getting this book into local bookstores because I think they're so amazing. Powell Books has it. On my website, all this information. And I would love for people to tell me what they think of the book because it's a book that you can just apply to your life immediately.
Well, it's been a great discussion. Our guest has been Jody Levon. The book is The Happy Medium, Speaking the Language of Intuition. Jody, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me. This is so much fun.
Jody was such a great guest. I really enjoyed my time with her. And she's one of those people whose just spirit comes across to you as a very positive, kind of bubbly person. And I'm sure we'll have her back on the show in future months to come. And next, we're going to have Jan Bondesen. He's going to talk to us about Strange Victoriana. But first, this very important message. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Harry's. Yes, they are back, the best razor blades in the world, and we're so glad to have them back on the show. I love Harry's. I love the close shave. I love the smoothness, the comfortable glide. Also, another thing I love is the convenience, the fact that I don't have to go through all of this bother going to the drugstore, paying these massive prices, waiting for some guy with a ring full of keys a mile long to open up the case because he has to get me razor blades. Those days are over with Harry's. It's convenient, but it's quality. And it goes back to the founders, Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys who basically were fed up with getting ripped off by the big razor blade companies. So they said, you know what? We're going to scratch our own itch and we're going to create a company to fix shaving. And that company is Harry's. Now, Jeff and Andy knew there was only one way to ensure quality. So they went out and they bought their own factory. That's putting your money where your mouth is. So by taking less profit and selling directly to you over the internet, Harry's can offer their blades at half off the price, just $2 a blade compared to the four or more you'll pay at the drugstore. Now, not only is there economy, not only is there convenience having them delivered straight to your door, but there's also quality. Close, comfortable shave because they have this great ergonomic handle that kind of harkens back to the day when things were really built to last. You feel that quality in the handle. A 5 precision engineered blade with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. Now, not only that, you've got quality, you've got convenience, you've got this great origin story, but I'm going to tell you about the best deal we've ever had on the Paranormal Podcast for Harry. So listen closely. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they want you to try their shave set for free. You heard that right. Just cover shipping when you sign up. Plus, as a special offer for fans of the show, go to harrys.com right now and enter code Jim at checkout to get a post-shave balm, also free. That's harrys.com, code Jim. harrys.com, code Jim. I love them. You're going to love them. So many of our listeners over the years have said, I love Harry's. Do check it out. Thanks, Harry's. Well, I love these ideas of Fortiana. Fortiana from way back, you know, of course, we have Charles Fort, History of the Damned, and so forth. Really, really fascinating stuff. And we have a great new volume out, Strange Victoriana, Tales of the Curious, the Weird, and the Uncanny from our Victorian ancestors. And our guest today is the author of said book. He's a return guest, Dr. Jan Bondesen. And Dr. Bondesen is a senior lecturer at Cardiff University. He lived in London for many years and has spent decades studying the criminal history of the metropolis. Of his many critically acclaimed books, his Amberley titles include Queen Victoria's Stalker and Amazing Dogs. He lives in Newport in Wales, and we're so glad to have him on the program today. Dr. Bondesen, welcome back.
Thank you, and nice to be back on the show.
So what inspired you to delve into Strange Victoriana, and what is Strange Victoriana?
Well, the book Strange Victoriana is a collection of Fortean stories about ghosts, hauntings, strange animals, strange performers that go back long before Charles Fort was active. It's all from Victorian times, and I am back in 2010. I met an old man in Cardiff who had a very large newspaper collection, including a long run of the old newspaper Illustrated Police News, mostly illustrations of Victorian murder cases, but also folders like marked as Somnambulists, Lion Wagers, Hermits and Misers, and Trouble with Polar Bears. So quite a treasure trove of old stories about Fortean events, strange events from Victorian times. And I made this into a serial. It's been running nearly every month in the Fortean Times magazine since 2011. And now I've collected the stories to become a book, and about half of them have been published before in the Fortean Times, and half of them are entirely new material.
I just thought maybe we'd go through certain parts of the book and discuss it. And it is striking that there seemed to be a certain fixation at that time with people with medical problems, and maybe where certain parts of the bodies were malformed, or there'd be some kind of congenital defect that would come to the fore in their appearance. I'm thinking of something like someone like the Elephant Man, the quote Elephant Man, John Merrick, I believe was his name. So it was kind of unfortunate in many ways how these people were kind of, and I'll use the word that were used for them at that time, the unfortunate phrase was that of quote freaks. I know you delve about that into the book, and it is, you know, it's sad to see how maybe these people were ostracized and kind of treated like animals at a zoo. But can you talk about that, the people that were focused on in this section and some of their stories?
Well, I've written several books on medical oddities in the past, like Cabinets of Medical Curiosities and The Two-Headed Boy. So I, of course, took care to include some such stories in the present volume as well, like the famous Russian giant Fyodor Makhnov, Phineas Barnum and his freaks. And in particular, on the cover of the book is Andrian, the dog-faced man of Russia, who looks rather like a Skye Terrier. His face looks like that of a Shaggy Terrier dog, really. And he was exhibited for money in the 1870s, and he had been imported into Britain from Russia, from the province of Kostroma, and he was an alcoholic who could drink a pint of undiluted vodka with his luncheon beefsteak with no problem at all. And he was quite an unprepossessing character, but he had a little son, or rather an illegitimate son, who is also on the cover of my book, and his name was Fyodor. And Fyodor was much more intellectually active than his poor father, and Fyodor had been exhibited in France and in England, and he soon could master the languages, and he later had a distinguished career in the American sideshow under the name Jojo the Dog-Faced Boy. And as for another individual featured in my book is the Scottish giant William Campbell, who was said to be the heaviest man in Britain, although nobody ever weighed him, so that remains rather dubious. He wasn't particularly well treated either. He had been very big and heavy and fat since he was a boy, and he couldn't very well do any work anymore, so he had to put himself on show as well in London, dressed in Highland attire with a kilt and a sporran and so on. And the tragic thing was that he was already a dying man at the time, because he had an infection in his legs, erysipelas of his legs, and also he had a heart problem due to smoking too much, I presume, and his lungs were not in a healthy state either, so he died the same year as he went on show. And he, by that time, he was the landlord of a public house in Newcastle, and they had to knock down a wall to the pub to be able to get the coffin out.
Oh, my. And why were people in this era so fascinated by this? I mean, when we see something today, like somebody with a medical challenge or Siamese twins or something, and now there's so many ways to separate people and maybe help them with some of these situations. Why was there such a kind of fixation on people who have been so unfortunate to be visited upon by these kind of conditions?
Well, one reason is that there was no competition in those days. There was no television. They couldn't watch South Park, or they couldn't watch The Simpsons. So they had to seek more earthy and simple amusements in the music halls, and in Victorian times, or well, throughout Victorian times, and well into Edwardian times. There was an established infrastructure for the exhibition of freaks, either homegrown or imported from all over the world. So most of the giants and dwarfs and conjoined twins exhibited in America, they had previously had a stint in England, and people were quite fascinated, and they didn't feel particularly sorry for these poor characters at all. They thought they were just as funny as maybe a juggler or some other performer on stage.
Yeah, that said, I mean, on one hand, I have to remember that we're looking at things from our perspective. I have confidence that 100 or 200 years from now, people down the road will look back at us and say, oh my goodness, how could they be so insensitive to X and so, thus and so. So I think you have to be sensitive to the fact that they were in a different time. It was through their prism. But still, it just seems quite unfortunate and sad that they would treat people in this way. Now, you have a section in here about hermits and misers. Were these people that were discovered? You know, we hear the stories about people who are discovered and they are living like they're penniless and they're sitting on millions of dollars hoarded away. What were you talking about when you talk about hermits and misers?
When I went through the clippings from the Illustrated Police News and other newspapers, there was a large folder entitled Hermits and Misers, and it contained a tidy few nice illustrations and nice stories. And one of the best is that of a Welsh hermit named Joseph Mason, who was prosecuted for failing to support his wife. And it turned out that he had become a hermit up in the Welsh mountains above the lead mines of Gogainan. And a workhouse officer was sent to search for him and managed to find a little hermitage up in the mountains, and although the locals warned him not to approach the angry, unpredictable hermit, but he opened the door and could see the old hermit sit glaring at him in a corner. But then he was attacked by an army of rats, an army of large rats. He stamped his foot to scare the rodents away, but instead they attacked him and leapt up and bit at his trousers and put him to headlong flight. And it turned out that the old hermit had devoted his time to taming the rats and training them to attack intruders.
Oh, my.
There is an illustration of the rats jumping at the workhouse officers. And the story originated in the local Welsh papers, and it's probably true.
I love the idea. He trained the rats to attack people who would come. And I mean, obviously, rats are very intelligent. Not my cup of tea, but I know there's many people who absolutely love them. Now, we wouldn't be doing the paranormal podcast if we didn't talk about the supernatural a little bit. And you have a section here talking about ghosts. So ghosts were part of the picture back then, too.
Well, there are many ghost stories in the old Illustrated Police News, and there was a large folder in this collection, all of them with good illustrations. Perhaps the most famous ghost in the book is the ghost of Berkeley Square in central London. And there was a tradition in the Victorian times that the terraced house at number 50 Berkeley Square, right in the middle of London, was haunted because it looked very dilapidated. It hadn't seen a lick of paint for ages. There was a story that a man who had slept in the haunted room, he had died from fright, and the girl had gone mad in the same room. And after that, the house had been deserted. But the more I looked into the story, the more fishy it got, really. And it was actually an adaptation of a fictional ghost story. And the truth behind it was that the old man who lived in the house, he had severe Parkinson's disease. So he could be seen sometimes walking through the rooms late at night with a candle. And then, of course, they thought it was the ghost. And he never went out because he couldn't walk very far due to his condition. And he didn't see any point in maintaining his house. And the reason the house was reputed to be haunted was its very dilapidated appearance. So there wasn't much in the Berkeley Square ghost. But then I have the haunted murder house at the Knowle St. Giles near Chard, where an old man named Samuel Churchill was murdered by his wife in 1879. And after the murder, the house was haunted. And the Illustrated Police News has an article that I quote here. In March last, an old man named Churchill was murdered in a cottage near Chard. For some time after the execution, the building remained uninhabited, but at length it was let to a laborer and his family. But the incomers soon found that they could obtain no rest. They state that the murderers has frequently been seen to glide about the premises in ghostly attire, and old Churchill has been distinctly observed to look in at the window with hideous countenance. And the blood was seen on the floor of the room in which the murder was committed. There were supernatural movements among the furniture and other articles, and unearthly noises, so that the occupants of the murder cottage were soon put to flight. And there was a feature on my book in the local newspaper, and I made an appeal to find this strange murder cottage that was the British equivalent of the Amityville House of Horrors, wasn't it? But nobody was able to identify it because there were so many rural county cottages in those parts in those days.
Our guest is Dr. Jan Bondesen. The book is Strange Victoriana, Tales of the Curious, the Weird, and the Uncanny from Our Victorian Ancestors. And we'll be back on the Paranormal Podcast right after this.
Want to keep up on the latest paranormal news? Then follow at TheJimHarold on Twitter. Jim is constantly tweeting out top stories on the supernatural. I want to know, when does this guy sleep? Anyway, follow Jim at TheJimHarold on Twitter today. Now we return to the show.
We're back on the Paranormal Podcast with our guest, Dr. Jan Bondesen. We are talking about Strange Victoriana, Tales of the Curious, the Weird, and the Uncanny from Our Victorian Ancestors. And before we went to the break, Dr. Bondesen, you were talking about ghosts, but you told me during the break you have a couple of more good ghost stories you'd like to share. So we always love ghost stories, so please have at it.
Yes, I'll start with the Plumstead ghost of 1897. So in those days, there was a church in Plumstead, just in the east of London, called St. James's Church, and there was also a St. James's School with a lot of schoolboys. And in 1879, there were rumors that a ghost was at large in the churchyard, A schoolmaster had been frightened out of his wits when the ghost suddenly grabbed hold of him from behind and shouted, "Boo-ha!" And an old couple visiting the churchyard had seen the ghost sitting in a tree making use of the same outcry. When another schoolmaster took a walk in the churchyard, he was also accosted by the ghost, but he had with him a large Newfoundland dog. And he set the dog on the spectre, and he could hear the ghost give a yelp when the dog's fangs made contact with its buttocks. So he was convinced that the ghost was flesh and blood, and he instructed the schoolboys not to be timid, but to teach the ghost a hard lesson if they saw it again. And the very same evening, the ghost made another appearance, and a mob of schoolboys, 100 strong, went into the churchyard and they pelted the ghost with stones. They didn't score any hits, but instead they broke some valuable stained glass in the church. The ghost was eventually caught in the garden of a neighbor, where it was sitting in a tree and making use of its usual outcry. And the ghost turned out to be an engineer who had lost much money in litigation and lost his mind as a result. And he was put under restraint in an asylum, and the Plumstead ghost was laid to rest. And another spook in my book is the fighting ghost of Tondi. Tondi is not very well known. It's an obscure little Welsh village in South Wales. And back in 1904, it was haunted by a large ghostly creature in a white clothing. And when some workmen saw the ghost come gliding towards them with a drawn-out boo, with the great black sockets that took the place of the eyes fixed straight ahead, all 12 sturdy Welsh miners took to their heels and they didn't even dare to look back. And not long after, another Welshman was walking home late at night when the ghost was waiting for him, and it grabbed hold of him with a hearty goodwill, with a vice-like grip that he could hardly breathe. And when he tried to grapple with this singular ghost, his hands just met in air. And having toppled its opponent over, the fighting ghost of Tondi glided off with a hollow laugh. And there was much newspaper writing about this extraordinary ghost that was... it was pugnacious enough to put 12 strong men to flight and then successfully wrestle another. And the people of Tondi were out with the bludgeons and pitchforks to patrol the country roads to stop the fighting ghost. But all of a sudden the haunting stopped and the fighting ghost of Tondi was never seen again.
I love ghost stories. They are absolutely fantastic. And I love these historical ones. They add a whole new dimension to it. So one thing that you have in here that I love, and I have somebody I think of particularly, I don't know if you covered him in the book because he's really French, but strange performers. The strangest performer that I can recall hearing about was Le Petit-Main, who was, I hate to be so crass, but he was a professional. He did flatulence on stage, and that was very popular. What other kind of strange performers did you have happen to find from this era?
Well, I have quite a few, and in those days they had a fascination with parachutes and flying machines, and there were several of these artists bringing flying machines to London and trying them out and sometimes losing their lives as a result. One of them was Mynheer de Groof, and a Dutchman who tried out a flying machine in 1874. And it was dropped from a balloon, and it was supposed to glide down peacefully towards the London streets. But instead it fell like a stone, and the Mynheer de Groof was killed on the spot. And the balloonist fainted dead away when he saw his colleague plummet to death. And the balloon swerved dangerously and drifted towards Essex. And when the smelling salts had been applied to the swooned aeronaut, his balloon was in serious danger of crash landing. In the end, he managed to land it on an Essex railway lane, but then the train approached. The driver managed to bring the train to a standstill, however, and there were no further casualties as a result of de Groof's foolhardy experiment.
Well, the thing is that, and I think you did a very good job of mentioning this before, there was no television. There was, obviously, there was no competition, as you said. There was no internet, certainly. So, I mean, you're in a situation where you had newspapers, you had books, but there wasn't a lot of visual competition. So the things that people would find entertaining then would make us quite surprised now.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, The Illustrated Police News was founded in 1864. It was a weekly newspaper, and the first page was all illustrations, which was quite a novel concept in those days, although there had been illustrated newspapers already back in the 1830s. And it's difficult to say why it was incepted in 1864. It may well have been because another penny paper, the penny illustrated paper, was inaugurated in 1861. And when the founders of the Police News saw that the penny illustrated paper was able to make good money, although an issue cost just a penny, they decided to found a paper mostly about criminals, but also with weird news from all over the world. And in America, there was a similar paper called the National Police Gazette.
Yeah, and people think things like the National Enquirer and those things are totally new. I mean, there was always some kind of publication to fulfill that need for the sensational. And that goes to the rich and famous. I mean, again, we think about, you know, people following the exploits and everything that Kim Kardashian does is a new thing. But people back then had a fascination with the rich and famous, didn't they?
They did indeed. And many of those notorious people, misdeeds of the rich and famous, made it into the Illustrated Police News. And scandals among the upper classes was given, they were given much room in the newspaper, like divorce cases. And there was an instance of Thomas Carlyle, the famous historian and literary lion of Victorian times. He used to live at number 24 Cheney Row in Chelsea. And after he had died, the house was taken over by a very strange woman, the widow of an army surgeon, and she believed in spiritualism and held seances in Carlyle's old house. And she also had a great fondness for cats and dogs and kept more than 50 animals on the premises. And she used to feed all the cats of Chelsea outside the house with huge feline banquets that attracted a lot of vast numbers of cats to the neighborhood. And in the end, the house was considered a nuisance due to the 20 dogs being in the house, and it smelt quite terrible. And in the end, she was evicted from the premises, and she died of delirium tremens not long after. And today, Carlyle's house is a museum, and I've been there more than once, and it's not haunted by any spectral cats and dogs. So animal hoarders were a well-known phenomenon already in Victorian times.
Now, crime. Crime, and you talked about the other publication that focused, the American one that focused on crime. I would think that murders and these types of things would be a lot of fodder for something like this.
Well, the Illustrated Police News was mostly about murders, and I have used the illustrations from this archive in my earlier book, Rivals of the Ripper, about unsolved murders of London women in late Victorian times. And I've used it in this book, and I've also used it in a forthcoming book that may well be called The Murderous Victoriana, that will be out next year. And in this book, I have a few tales of crime and mystery. And one of them concerns the Great Speke mystery of 1868. There was a clergyman, the Reverend Benjamin Speke, and he went attend a wedding in London. He took the train, and he went to buy a tall hat to wear. And after that, he entirely disappeared, but a tall hat was found by a bystander and handed over to the police. And there was much rumors what had happened to the Reverend Benjamin Speke. Had he been kidnapped for ransom, or had he been murdered by foreign criminals, or had he maybe he had been decoyed into a cab where he had been chloroformed or knocked out cold with a boxing glove fastened to a powerful spring? Or had he perhaps been taken to a brothel in Tangiers, a city where the most unnatural vices abounded? But the Reverend Benjamin Speke was never found again, and no ransom demand was received, and people started to lose interest when a tramp was arrested in Padstow in Cornwall. And they thought he was a wanted criminal, so they took him into custody. But when they went through the files of fugitives and missing people, they found that he instead fitted the description of the Reverend Benjamin Speke quite perfectly. And the man had to admit that he was really the missing clergyman, and he had been was engaged to be married himself, and this was thought to be the reason why he had escaped. To avoid his marriage, and after leaving his tall hat in Birdcage Walk as a decoy, he left London in disguise and tramped round the West Country for many weeks, visiting various churches and monuments. And his plan was to go to the United States, but he had never made it all the way there. And so he returned to his flock in Dowlish Wake, and well-deserved obscurity, but the story ends sadly. He again became engaged to be married in 1869, and this time he made it all the way to the altar. But in 1881, Mrs. Speke died, and the Reverend drowned himself the following day, leaving his many children orphans.
Oh my, my goodness. So out of all these different stories that you have covered in the book, what is a favorite for you that we've not covered, one that really stuck with you?
Well, there is a story of Kenneth Graham, the famous children's author, the one who wrote The Wind in the Willows about Mr. Toad and those talking animals. And back in 1903, he was the secretary of the Bank of England, and it took an up-and-coming banker who took his career seriously. But on Christmas Eve 1903, he had a visitor, a Mr. George Frederick Robinson, who looked like a perfect gentleman. But unfortunately for Kenneth Graham, he was not just a socialist anarchist, but a stark raving lunatic as well. He had brought with him a roll of paper with a white string at one end and a black string round the other, and he knew that if Kenneth Graham grabbed the black string, then he was one of the bad bankers who hoarded money in the vaults while the poor were starving, and if he grabbed the white one, he was one of the good bankers. But he did grab the black one. And then Robinson, he pulled a large revolver and started firing at him. But he didn't manage to hit Kenneth Graham. Kenneth Graham ran out of the room, and the lunatic pursued him with the revolver at the ready. And at the end, they managed to contain him in the library of Bank of England, and they made use of the fire hose, and they managed to subdue him. And he was sent to Broadmoor. And maybe his ghost is still haunting that famous old asylum, waving the heavy revolver about and saying, "I was right all the time. Those damn bankers couldn't be trusted."
Oh my.
And as for Kenneth Graham, he lost interest in banking altogether after his narrow escape, and he started writing stories about talking animals living quietly in the countryside. And he resigned from the Bank of England in 1905, just before the publication of The Wind in the Willows.
Well, there you have it. What a turnabout. Very interesting. Well, the whole discussion's been interesting. Our guest has been Dr. Jan Bondesen. The book is Strange Victoriana, Tales of the Curious, the Weird, and the Uncanny from Our Victorian Ancestors. Dr. Bondesen, where can people find the book?
It can be had on Amazon and in specialist bookshops as well, and also there's something called the Book Depository on the internet nowadays, but I think Amazon would be a good bet.
Well, very good. Dr. Jan Bondesen, thank you for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast.
And thank you for inviting me.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that edition of the Paranormal Podcast as much as I did. Next week, we have Nick Redfern joining us to talk about immortality of the gods and another guest who will be named later, but I'm sure you're going to enjoy them as well. And I hope that you will tell your friends and family about the Paranormal Podcast and Campfire, my ghost story, supernatural story podcast, and check that out if you haven't. But that's how we spread the word. You know, I was just listening to a podcast about podcasts the other day, and I hear that some of these big companies who are putting out podcasts, they have staffs of 10 or 20 people. Well, that ain't the case here. But what we do have is more important. We have you, because this is from the grassroots up. So it will grow and more people will learn about the shows if you deem it to spread the word. So I ask that you do that. Next time you talk to a friend or family member who's into the spooky like you, say, hey, check out this Jim Harold guy. I'd really appreciate it. Also, please rate and review us on iTunes. It helps more than you'll ever know. We thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next time on The Paranormal Podcast. Bye-bye, everybody. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.